Hello, I'm Chris Epting. This is number 0109, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0109. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Owen Colfer, who is best known as the author of the Artemis Fowl series. Well, now he's writing for adults with his new book entitled Plugged, and right on the front of the new book it says, if you loved Artemis Fowl, it's time to grow up. Why is that there?
The main one is to show that it's not for kids. But also then, many of the Artemis Fowl fans started to read it when they were 15 and they're 25, 26 now. So it's maybe just to point them in the direction of a writer they used to like when they were kids.
Chip Carter is the author of Obsessed with Star Trek. Is it possible to be too obsessed with Star Trek?
I think you can only be overly obsessed if you're actually hurting people, and if the worst thing you're doing is dressing up like a Klingon and you're not washing your uniform every day after a convention, you're probably doing all right.
Linda Poitevin is the author of Sins of the Angels, a book that has action, suspense, and yes, angels. What was the genesis of the first in what will be a series?
The whole series started with, believe it or not, a song by Sarah McLachlan called Angel. Watching the movie City of Angels, I heard the song and it sparked an idea in me. It led to some conversations with a very good friend of mine who had a Catholic school background. She filled me in on the whole backstory of Lucifer and the fallen angels, and I started doing research, and now I have an entire series.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0109, is author Chris Epting, who has been a guest on this program before, and he's written many books on pop culture history, such as Hello, It's Me, Dispatches from a Pop Culture Junkie, James Dean Died Here, The Locations of America's Pop Culture Landmarks, Roadside Baseball, A Guide to Baseball Shrines Across America, and more. Check out his fan page on Facebook, and you'll find a link to it on the Stuff File page. And thank you very much once again, Mr. Epting, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, it's bad enough when someone plows their car through your house and kills your roommate. Even worse when the ensuing police investigation means the cops find your in-home pot farm and coke stash. In Chicago, 28-year-old Zachary Eisenberg was standing by his couch when a 1995 Mercury Marquis came crashing through his home, pinning him underneath the vehicle. Apparently a neighbor, Patricia Dalton, was backing out of her driveway when her accelerator became stuck. Eisenberg's roommate, 27-year-old Thomas Misucci, told police the two men were playing video games when they heard a noise outside. Eisenberg stood up to see what was going on when the car came right through the house. Eisenberg was transported to an area hospital where he was later pronounced dead. But as officers began to search Eisenberg and Misucci's home for more victims, they came across a locked door. Behind it was a small pot-growing operation in a bathroom. Misucci was in the hospital at the time when officers discovered the 13 marijuana plants along with a half ounce of cocaine and a firearm in Misucci's bedroom. So Mr. Misucci, who is already a convicted felon, was arrested and charged with illegal possession of a firearm by a felon, a Class 3 felony, and production of marijuana, a Class 4 felony. Gee, do you think that comes under the heading of having a really bad day? Yeah. Anyway, as if California doesn't already have enough budget problems, they also have to deal with Jeffrey Rolfing. Now, according to a Los Angeles Times investigation, Rolfing is the highest paid state government employee and also the state's least productive. Rolfing is on the payroll as a surgeon in the state prison system and receives a base pay of $235,740 per year. That's base, by the way, which means he could earn more. However, he has been barred from treating inmates for the last 6 years because supervisors believe him to be incompetent. It gets worse. Last year, Dr. Rolfing earned an additional $541 in back pay after he successfully appealed his firing to the state's personnel board. Currently, Dr. Rolfing is assigned record-keeping duties for which he is paid, as I said earlier, $235,740 per year. Yeah. Hey, what's up, Doc? Wow. And not unlike the dark, comedic movie Weekend at Bernie's, two men in Denver have been accused of driving around town with a dead friend, running up a bar tab on his account, and using his ATM card at a strip club. 43-year-old Robert Young and 25-year-old Mark Rubinson stand charged with
abuse of corpse.
Also, identity theft and criminal impersonation. Now, while it's unclear how their friend, 43-year-old Jeffrey Jarrett, died, the men are not charged with his death. Allegedly, Young arrived at Jarrett's home and found him unresponsive. But rather than call the authorities, police say he went to find Rubinson. The duo returned to Jarrett's home and put his lifeless body into Rubinson's SUV and headed to a night spot where they spent more than an hour drinking, leaving Jarrett's body in the vehicle and using his ATM card to pay for the drinks. Rubinson and Young then drove to another restaurant to hang out, Jarrett's body still slumped in the backseat of the car. They then returned to Jarrett's home, carried him in, and put him to bed. From there, police say Rubinson and Young went to get gas and made a stop at a burrito joint, again using Jarrett's card. Then it was off to a strip club, where they allegedly used Jarrett's card to take out $400 from an ATM. As the men left the Shotgun Willie's strip club parking lot, one told a valet and a police officer standing nearby that they were driving around with a dead guy and they didn't know what to do with it, and then they just were going to go home really fast. Police then went to Jarrett's home and found the body. Now, what I want to know is, how did they get his PIN number? And what was the reason for actually taking him out in the first place, since they brought him back home in the end? If they were going to use his card and go have a night on the town, do they need the body in the car? And really, why do you bother telling a valet and a police officer that you have a dead body that you don't know what to do with? I tell you, these two guys almost became the idiot of the day, but they did not. That is later. We have one more item in the Stuff File news before we get to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In February, 12 villagers from a South African shantytown allegedly burned down a pastor's home and killed him out of anger and fear that he was using an invisible penis to seduce women. Yes. The accused, who are due to answer for their superstition in court this month, became 11 in May when one of the men died mysteriously, and the remaining 11 are now terrified that the pastor's family have placed an active curse on them. Ah, yes, beware of the magical, invisible penis and the curse it might hold. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Owen Colfer is the creator of the biggest-selling young adult series in publishing history. I'm talking about Artemis Fowl. But he's now ventured into writing for the purely adult audience with his latest book, the thriller Plugged. Owen Colfer is on the line with us right now. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
Right on the cover of the new book, it says, "If you loved Artemis Fowl, it's time to grow up."
Yes. Well, I can't. There's a couple of reasons for that tagline. I think one, the main one, is to show that it's not for kids. But also, then many of the Artemis Fowl fans started to read it when they were 15, and they're 25, 26 now. So it's maybe just to point them in the direction of a writer they used to like when they were kids.
Is it a different muscle for you to write a book that is not geared toward young readers?
Not really. I kind of approach every book a little differently. What I try to do is find a voice that works for the book. And when I finish one book, it takes me a couple of months maybe to transition across to a new voice. But with this one, it's like I've been holding this voice back for 10 years. So it just really, I found it very easy to write, and I had great fun writing it, and nothing was off limits. I didn't have to self-censor. So it was very enjoyable, actually. And it wasn't harder. I mean, I don't think I possibly could think harder, but if you've read any of this book, you'll know that I probably didn't really think that hard. It's just a fun read, I think, I hope.
You mentioned the idea of self-censoring, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We live, unfortunately, in this really politically correct world, and when you peg yourself as someone who writes, or at least previously writes for young adults, for teens, it seems to be that everyone wants to jump on some sort of bandwagon saying this is either appropriate or inappropriate. Was that a difficult process to go through, sort of holding back, or did you never worry about critics in that regard?
I do worry a lot in general. I'm an anxious person. But that period when I'm actually writing a book, I have this ability to compartmentalize that. So when I'm actually working on the book, all I think about is the book. But beforehand, I fret. And then when the book's gone in, I worry, was this the right career move? Are the critics going to savage it? Is it the wrong thing to do? But luckily, by that point, it's gone. And it's gone based on just on my creative instincts. So it's too late then. And I mean, I did worry when this came out that it was going to get into the hands of 12-year-olds, and I really don't want that to happen. So I had to make sure the cover was very much, it looked really like an adult book, and it said on the front, "It's time to grow up if you like the Artemis Fowl." So, and on the back, it gives a pretty good description. So yeah, I do worry now, but I didn't worry when I was actually in the process.
As I mentioned in the introduction, Plugged is a thriller. Tell us what the story is about.
It concerns this ex-Irish Army guy, Daniel McAvoy, who was in the Lebanon in the peacekeeping force. And so he's got a few scars from that. So he moves away. He decides he wants to get away from the war. He wants to get away from home. So he moves to New Jersey, and he becomes a doorman in a casino. And while he's there, he meets a friend of his, a friend from Israel, and the guy is a cosmetic surgeon, and he convinces Dan to have hair implants, hence the title Plugged. But after his first session, unfortunately, his surgeon is kidnapped, and so he's left with a 50% hair plugs coverage, and he must find this guy, or else he's going to have to pay big money to get a proper surgeon to fix it up. So it's, as you can hear from that summary, it's not really, it's not overly serious. But there are serious moments, I think.
Well, I was about to say, in addition to being a thriller and involving suspense, there is a lot of humor in the book.
There is. It's kind of dark humor. Irish people really like that kind of humor. I said once that, you know, if some people have what's called black humor, we've got what, black hole humor. It's so dark. Our humor is, we see the funny side in everything, and I think that's a lot to do with the history of the country. You know, sometimes there's no choice but to laugh. So you find that in other places. You find it in Scotland. You find it in New York. I think you find it in places in Canada. So hopefully people who like, it's not laugh out loud funny. It's kind of maybe a chuckle, that kind of funny.
When you first started writing the Artemis Fowl series, did you think it was a series? And conversely, with this new character, do you see future stories involved in future books?
With the Artemis Fowl books, I thought I would do three. That was my initial plan, and I'm currently writing number 8, which is the last one. So it went a lot further than I thought, and I think just as the characters grew, I realized I can do more with them. I've never said before how many I would do, but now I'm saying definitely this one coming up will be the last one, because I think, you know, after 10 years, it's time to move on.
And Plug, do you see this character going forward?
Yeah, I'd like to get a couple. I'd like to do three books. It really depends on how it does. I think it's doing okay, because the publishers have already asked me would I do two more, so that's a good sign. I would love to do three. I enjoyed being in that world. I liked
it's a real release for me. It's good. They're really good fun to write. You can write them pretty quickly, and it was just the whole experience for me thus far. Even the touring has been very enjoyable. So, and it's nice talking to grown-ups as well, for a change.
You've acknowledged right on the cover of the book that Artemis Fowl readers have probably grown up. Would the character himself ever grow up?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I have thought about that. Would it be a good idea to do an Artemis Fowl book when he's 25 and he's entrenched in his criminal empire? Yeah, so it is definitely something I have thought about. I haven't put any serious thought into it, but I think it could make an interesting idea. So it is something we could see in the next 5 or 6 years.
In this day and age, whenever a new character comes out from a popular writer, whenever a new book is released, there's ultimately talk of turning it into a film. Do you ever, in your mind's eye, when you're writing books, do you ever think of who might play the characters you create?
I did that. I remember when the first Artemis Fowl book came out, that's 11 years ago, there was a lot of talk then about making it into a movie, and I had sold the film rights and everything, and I very naively thought, well, this is going to happen next year, and it's going to be great. But one of the then producers said something to me, that it would be very difficult for them with special effects to put the humans and the fairy people together. And they said it's no problem to do them apart, but when they come together, it's quite difficult. And I thought about this, and I found myself thinking about it in the second book when I was writing it. I think I better not put the humans and the fairies together because it'll be really difficult for the special effects people. And I caught myself thinking that, and I said, right, that's it. I'm never thinking about a movie again when I'm writing a book because it starts to affect how you write. So I said, I would just put that out of my mind. And the only thing that concerns me now is writing the book. I mean, if there was a movie made, I think I would hope, especially with the Artemis Fowl people, that they just find a young guy, a new young person, because it's such a great part, I think, for a young actor. I think they'd need to find somebody that's not known for something else.
You have such a core audience with the Artemis Fowl books. Admittedly, yes, they have grown up with the character as you've been writing him. But now with Plugged, is it almost like starting over again, or do you have a large enough base who are really Owen Colfer fans and they'll read what you write?
I think it's a little bit like starting again. I suppose I'm maybe two steps up the ladder in that there's a couple of people who will pick it up because of the Artemis Fowl thing on the cover, but people don't really know my name and it's hard to pronounce, and I feel, and it's funny because I'm on tour now, and I'm used to going to bookstores that are packed with people, and hundreds of people and queues out the door. But now I imagine I'm doing my first reading today actually in Boston, and I imagine that it's going to be pretty empty, and that's going to be a little depressing. You never know; maybe I'll be surprised. But I don't think on the first week of a new book in the new series that there are going to be too many people showing up. So I suppose that'll take a little getting used to.
Well, you may be surprised, and we wish you all the luck. The new book is called Plugged, and it says a wickedly funny crime thriller recounting the bizarre exploits of Daniel McAvoy. I thank you very much, Owen, for taking the time to be on the program with us. People can also check out your website, which is owenculfer.com, and I should spell that, EOINCOLFER.com, and I'm sure they'll find out lots of information about the book and also your appearances there.
Absolutely. Everything is on the website, so you can find out all about the book, and I think if you go on to the Overlook website, all my appearances will be listed there.
Thank you very much, Owen.
Thank you. Bye now.
Owen Colfer, author of Plugged. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0109, and you'll find links to Owen's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the author of Obsessed with Star Trek, plus the author of Sins of the Angels. And we have, of course, an idiot of the day. But first, more Stuff File news for you right here, right now. You know, perhaps they just wanted to join the proverbial mile high club, but a randy young couple on a Frontier flight from Denver to Detroit caused authorities to scramble fighter jets, bomb squads, and alert FBI and police on the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. On that Sunday afternoon, the TSA was notified of passengers allegedly behaving suspiciously aboard Frontier Airlines Flight 623, according to Denver FBI spokesman Dave Joly. Now, given it was the 10th anniversary of 9/11, out of an abundance of caution, the North American Aerospace Defense Command scrambled an F-16 at 3:30 p.m. to shadow the flight until it landed safely at Detroit Metropolitan Airport. The flight was then brought to a remote area of the airport, and the plane was swept by security personnel. The suspicious behavior turned out to be two people making out in the bathroom mid-flight. Three passengers were taken into custody for questioning, but no arrests were made. Okay, if it was a couple who was making out in the bathroom, how did three passengers end up in custody for questioning? Anyway, 59-year-old Paul Hopes was a purchasing agent for Toys R Us in Britain and a married father of two. But now he's up on charges that he stole nearly $6 million from the company, much of which went to very high-priced call girl Dawn Dunbar. Judge Stephen John calculated the weekly average Dunbar was paid, which she admitted was 10 times the going rate, and came into at about $31,000 a week. When the judge asked her, "How do you justify that?" she replied, "It wasn't me that was putting the worth on it. It was Mr. Hopes paying what he thought it was worth." Wow, she must have been good. Toys R Us are trying to get all the money back from her, but Dunbar's attorneys argue that it was money she earned, not given, and therefore it's rightfully hers. In the meantime, Mr. Hopes was sent to prison for 7 years and ordered to pay back millions he spent buying houses and cars for prostitutes. His wife, by the way, is also divorcing him. No big surprise there. A hearing with another one of Hopes' prostitutes, Tanya Wieck, is expected in the coming weeks. Wow, Toys R Us. You know, that could be the hooker's slogan, couldn't it? Anyway, 22-year-old Josephine Smith was arrested in St. Petersburg, Florida, after she allegedly attacked 69-year-old Milton Ellis in his wheelchair because she claimed to be a vampire. Smith was charged with battery after violently biting Ellis on his face and arms. Ellis told police that he and Smith met on the street and went to the porch of a vacant restaurant to get out of the rain. He said he fell asleep in his motorized wheelchair and woke up to find Smith on top of him saying, "I'm a vampire, I'm going to eat you." She then proceeded to bite him on his arm and lips, leaving him bloody before he was able to escape and call police. He's in a motorized wheelchair. How fast can he escape in that thing? Then again, I've seen some motorized wheelchairs. You got to watch out when they show up on the sidewalk. Anyway, he was later treated with stitches at a local hospital and released. After arriving at the scene, police said they found Smith's bloody and half-naked body nearby, but she had no memory of what happened and did not identify herself as a vampire at that time. Wow, chomping on a 69-year-old guy in a wheelchair. Doesn't food usually have a best before date? In case you didn't know, eating raw meat right off a Walmart shelf is actually illegal. Gee, there was a segue there somewhere, wasn't there? Police in Carlisle, Pennsylvania arrested 53-year-old Scott Shover for doing just that. He allegedly opened packages of raw ground beef and raw stew beef, helped himself to a few bites, and then put the packages back on the shelf. All this was witnessed by a Walmart employee, so a loss prevention officer and a store manager followed Shover outside and pointed him out to a police officer. He was arrested at taser point and charged with retail theft. The loss of the meat was valued at $24.53. Strangest part of the story is that from the looks of Shover's mugshot, he doesn't have any teeth. Love gumming me some raw beef, yeah. Of course, I have put his mugshot up on the Stuff File website if you want to take a look at it. Just go to the page for the corresponding program, which is show number 0109, and you'll see his picture in all his gumming glory. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, in Indiana, a McDonald's customer went into what has to be described as a violent rage over an ice cream birthday cake she left with them for safekeeping, which had later been handed back to her in a less than frozen state. She allegedly threw the cake at one employee and then slapped them in the face. The manager called 911 and police were dispatched. The best part is when the manager tells the 911 dispatcher, "No, I'm fine, just sticky." Yeah, if I had a nickel. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Attention Star Trek fans, there is a new quiz book that spans the entire history of the science fiction classic. It's called Obsessed with Star Trek, and it's written by Chip Carter. And Chip is on the line with us right now via Skype to Skype communications from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Chip.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, I got to ask you, is it Trekkie or Trekker?
I think both are acceptable. Well, I always say Trekkie for myself.
Oh, okay, just checking right now. Now, obsessed with Star Trek. I'm taken back to that infamous Saturday Night Live routine with William Shatner, where he yelled out "Get a life." And right now, I'm going to tell you, I'm in the Star Trek camp, so I understand this completely. But obsessed with Star Trek. are you obsessed with Star Trek? And do you find that there are some people who are overly so?
You know, I think you can only be overly obsessed if you're actually hurting people. And if the worst thing you're doing is dressing up like a Klingon, and you're not washing your uniform every day after a convention, you're probably doing all right.
So tell us about Obsessed with Star Trek. I mean, you've got it chocked filled with lots of information.
It has 2,500 questions that spans all the series and films, except for the latest, the J.J. Abrams film. And it also has an electronic computer module that keeps track of your score, so you can play against yourself or you can play against others. So it's pretty cool, so this, if I say so myself.
This is hardcore. You got the electronics involved, too. I mean, this is serious competition for some folks.
It is. And it's funny, people have actually been playing it and telling me, like, oh, my God, I'm winning. But, you know, it takes a long time to get through 2,500 questions.
Yes, it is. Now, the thing about Star Trek is it's almost to some folks like a religion. So I know everything that people do when it comes to writing obviously have editors and fact checkers, but you've really got to be careful with Star Trek, don't you?
Oh yeah, and in fact, that's how I got started. I worked at Paramount in the licensing side, so a lot of stuff would come through me for approval, and we had to check everything. So,
Now you've also written for Star Trek, have you not?
I pitched an episode. I did not actually get to write the episode. They wanted someone who really could write. but I did pitch an episode and sold that story idea. It was a seventh season Voyager, and it was the episode Shattered.
Oh, wow. Okay, so now when it comes to putting together this set, the Obsessed with Star Trek, are there different levels of difficulty?
There are. Each chapter sort of begins out easy. The questions are easier and then more medium. And then by the end of each chapter, they're going to get much tougher.
Okay, so give us an example. What is an easy question? What is a hard question?
An easy question would be, what is James T. Kirk's middle name?
Tiberius. Okay.
Exactly. So, okay, there you go. 1 point. Let me put that into the computer module. I want to make sure we're keeping a score here.
Oh,
so
thanks.
Something like, what furry Star Trek original series alien was briefly seen in the bar scene in the movie Star Trek III: The Search for Spock?
Wow. I would just guess Tribble.
You're correct, and it probably would be a little easier if you were looking at it is multiple choice, so you'd be able to see that. So I could have hit you with, what type of propulsion does the USS Excelsior boast? But it might have been a little bit too tough. I don't want to,
Well, what is the answer to that one?
That would be transwarp.
Transwarp, okay. And I'm sorry, what was that?
Maybe you would have gotten that.
Well, I'm just about to ask, are all the questions multiple choice?
They are all multiple choice. That's why the computer module has buttons for A, B, C, and D.
Because it's one of those situations, I've watched every episode of Star Trek. I have them all. I'm thinking it's one of those things that if I had seen the answer, I would have probably gotten it.
Probably so, yes. So it does make it easier. However, some of the questions, like when you get into the numeric questions, like, are, how many light years away was this? That's a little tough even for me to remember.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, does it frighten you that someone can rattle them all off?
Not at all, but I was at the Star Trek convention here in Vegas recently, and someone asked me a question, and I had no clue. And she said, I actually just memorized that a long time ago so that if anybody ever had trivia going on, I could ask a question no one knew. And so I had to go home. I just had to go home and cry in my corner for a little while after that.
You've been involved in the Star Trek universe for quite a long time. You worked at Paramount, as you said. There are different incarnations of Star Trek. Do you have a favorite?
I do, and I love all of them for different reasons, but Voyager is always going to be kind of a special one to me because that was filming at the time that I was working there, and I got to know people on the crew and the cast and everything, so that's always going to kind of hold a special place in my heart.
And dare I say, is there any aspect of the Star Trek world you're not necessarily crazy about?
No, I love everything. of course. I mean, you've had, good Lord, like 45 years of stuff, and there's things that I don't necessarily agree with, but, that's life in general. There's always stuff. So, I wish they hadn't killed Tuvix.
The thing I like to think about Star Trek is that it is in a world where there is an abundance, even though there's conflict, there's an abundance of hope. Do you think
yes.
that's the biggest message Star Trek has to offer?
I think so. I think hope, hope for the future has always been kind of what drives the franchise, and I know that's what was, Roddenberry's vision was a hopeful future where, and again, it started, right at a time of war. And I think those things have resonated no matter in all these years. People still want, you know, to believe that the tomorrow is going to be better than today. And I think that really resonates with people. And it doesn't, you know, hurt to have some fun costumes and a big spaceship and being able to beam everywhere. It, you know, it just makes everything just a little bit more fun, too.
In our entertainment today, in a post 9/11 world, especially science fiction and fantasy seems to have taken a much darker tone. Do you think a Star Trek, even though with the J.J. Abrams movie was very, very good, do you think a Star Trek world could exist post 9/11 very successful, or is it even more needed today than it was back then?
Personally, I would say it's more needed. I think. You know, I am as old as Star Trek, and I definitely kind of, maybe it's nostalgia or maybe it's just foolish hope, but I look back to the more innocent times a little bit. I don't, you know, disregard that bad things happen and everything, but I do believe there are peaceful solutions and hopeful solutions for things. And so I definitely think there's still a place for that kind of optimism.
You mentioned you've been to the conventions. Do you have a Starfleet uniform?
I do not. When you work there, it's a little bit different. You can't really, you know, put that on. I don't wear my favorite band t-shirt to the concert that I'm going to, and that's kind of how I equate it. It's like, you know, you just can't do that.
Oh, okay. But when you're not at a convention and not at work, is there a Starfleet outfit in your closet somewhere?
No, there really isn't. Now, there might be a superhero outfit somewhere, but that I'm not going to admit to on radio. Captain Marvel. I mean, no, I didn't say that out loud.
Okay. One of the things, I mean, Star Trek is such a cottage industry. You've come out with Obsessed with Star Trek, this interactive game. And by the way, you've also co-edited two Star Trek comic books and developed Star Trek trading cards. Do you see Obsessed with Star Trek going on? I mean, right now you've got 2,500 questions. Do you anticipate another series of questions coming down the road later on?
I'd love that. I think it's going to depend on what happens next with the franchise. I think, you know, there's definitely another movie in the works. Who knows what's going to happen after that? But there's certainly more to be gleaned from the existing stuff. But after you've done 2,500 questions, and there was earlier trivia books, like back in the 70s, I believe there was a trivia book as well. It gets harder to not repeat things or get too close to other. Even doing this, my editor caught duplicates, you know, and I was trying to be very careful about not repeating questions. It gets hard because you don't want to be so minutia that no one could ever get it, but you don't want to be so obvious, like what hair color is Yeoman Rand's hair. I mean, you don't want to be that obvious either. So I think you need a little bit more content, but there's probably definitely still things that would be great trivia questions, just maybe not 2,500 of them, but one more time.
Or what color was Majel Barrett's hair in the original pilot?
It was black.
There you go.
Yes. Number one. Oh, yes.
There you go. The set is Obsessed with Star Trek. It's written by Chip Carter. And Chip, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, of course, Peter. Thank you so much for having me. I hope everybody that gets a copy enjoys it. So thank you very much.
Chip Carter, author of Obsessed with Star Trek. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0109, and you'll find links to Chip's website, plus links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In this season of hurricanes and severe storms, some of the biggest culprits in causing damage are fallen trees. While millions of Americans are helping their neighbors clean up, some people want to know if they should sue a neighbor whose tree has damaged their property. Well, here's what an expert in property law at one of our nation's top law schools recently said about that. The first thing to consider is whether the tree owner was negligent in caring for it. He said negligence is hard to prove. So the vast majority of people who own trees that cause damage during a storm are actually found not liable by courts. He believes that even if a person thinks he has a good case against a neighbor, he should think twice about suing. The high cost of lawsuits plus all the aggravation is the wrong way to clean up. Let's be fair. In storm season, taking a neighbor to court over damage caused by a fallen tree usually isn't worth the damage it causes between neighbors and in communities. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come in the program, we will talk to the author of Sins of the Angels. Plus, we have an idiot of the day, but right now, more Stuff File news to get through. Shirley the orangutan lives in a zoo in Malaysia, and she's got kind of a weird bad habit. Smoking. No kidding. Shirley is often spotted smoking cigarettes given to her by zoo visitors, but that's all coming to an abrupt halt as zookeepers are forcing her to kick the habit. Government authorities seized the adult ape after she and several other animals there were deemed to be living in poor conditions. Shirley is now being quarantined at another zoo and is expected to be sent to a Malaysian wildlife center on Borneo Island within weeks. Melaka Zoo Director Ahmed Azhar Mohammed made the incredibly brilliant and insightful statement, "Shirley is not being provided with any more cigarettes because smoking is not normal behavior for orangutans." Really? Wow, when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, it really isn't normal behavior for humans either, but I digress. It's not clear when Shirley started smoking. Officials have estimated she is around 20 years old. Other countries, such as South Africa and Russia, have also reported cases of primates learning to smoke after zoo visitors ignored warnings and tossed cigarettes into the cages of chimpanzees. Oh, they might have a bigger problem on their hands if they expect Shirley to peacefully survive quitting smoking cold turkey. Stay tuned. We might hear more about her and her future mood swings. Elsewhere, a Chinese man has had to have a 6-inch eel removed from his bladder after the serpentine sea dweller swam up his urethra. Oh, I love the way she sings respect. While he was undergoing an eel cleansing, he had hoped would make him look younger. 56-year-old Zhang Nan of Hangzhou, Hebei province, was immersed in a bath full of live eels when he felt a pain that he immediately attributed to an eel attempting to breach his member. "I tried to hold it and take it out," he says, "but the eel was too slippery to be held and it disappeared up my penis." Never quite said a sentence like that before, but anyway. Zhang rushed to the hospital where doctors were able to extract the curious critter after a 3-hour operation. Sadly, the eel did not survive the ordeal. "The diameter of the urethra in a man's penis is just a little narrower," explained surgeon Jin Wong, "but because eels are quite slippery, its body worked as a lubricant and so it got into the penis smoothly." Guys, was that TMI for you? Yeah. The more you know, the less you want to know when it comes to stories like that. Anyway, police say 29-year-old Luis Miguel Aguilar went full-out Cro-Magnon when he got into a fight outside a house party in Buena Park, California. Aguilar was arrested and accused of biting off his opponent's eyebrow. Yes, eyebrow. The 41-year-old victim, who was not named, but I'm sure he's easy to spot now, was rushed to a hospital where he actually tried to save the chewed-up piece of flesh. Doctors described it as a chunk of flesh containing the victim's right eyebrow, about the size of an egg. Unfortunately, they were unable to reattach it, and he'll have to have reconstructive surgery. Aguilar was arrested on suspicion of felony mayhem and was being detained on an immigration hold because he's allegedly undocumented. Nobody is quite sure what the fight was about, but witnesses say Aguilar punched the victim, got on top of him, straddled him, and then leaned in to bite off a big chunk of his right eyebrow area. Wow, do you think this is the first eyebrow this guy has chewed off? Methinks we should check a little more deeply into his undocumented past. We might find some interesting things. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Linda Poitevin is the author of Sins of the Angels. It's the first book in a series that deals with angels, but it also is filled with action and suspense. And Linda joins us on the line right now from Gatineau, Quebec. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. You have this story. First of all, it's part of a series. So how many books do you plan to write in this series?
At this point, there are four planned, but I'm only contracted for the two at the moment.
Okay. And in this world that your book takes place in, heaven and hell are real, God is a woman. What other things are we finding out?
God isn't perfect, which is a big one. God is fallible and imperfect and has all kinds of issues of her own. Can't give away too much because it would be spoiling a great portion of the actual series, so I would probably leave it at that as far as, you know, the overall arc.
Well, what led you to angel mythology in the first place? Are you a very religious person?
I am not. I differentiate between faith and religion, and I'm not a religious person. The whole series started with, believe it or not, a song by Sarah McLachlan called Angel. And watching the movie City of Angels, I heard the song, and it sparked an idea in me, led to some conversations with a very good friend of mine who had a Catholic school background. She filled me in on the whole backstory of Lucifer and the fallen angels, and I started doing research, and now I have an entire series.
Wow. Now, one of the things about religion or anything that touches on religion, especially in the entertainment sphere, as you know, some people take religion very seriously, and they don't like things being messed with. Are you prepared for any kind of backlash you might get?
Well, I look at it this way. Dan Brown got a whole lot of backlash, and he did just fine. So, yes, I am prepared for the backlash. What I would remind people is that this is a work of fiction. It is based in the Christian angel mythology, but the world that I've created is my own.
Okay. Now, in the Sins of the Angel, this follows a homicide detective. Tell us a little bit about the homicide detective.
A homicide detective is female, and she is in Toronto. She's a police officer of 13 years, as far as her career is concerned. Comes from a bit of a shaky background. Her mother was schizophrenic and killed her father and herself when the heroine, Alex, was 9 years old. Alex found the bodies. She is quite scarred by this. One of her reasons for going into police work in the first place. And it's one of the things that stands between her and her ability to buy into the whole possibility that what she's seeing and hearing could be real.
In your own writing process, how much do you know about your characters before you start to write, or do you actually learn about your characters as you write?
They are constantly surprising me. I do start out with what I think the characters are, and my husband laughs at me all the time because I'm always changing direction in the story because somebody said or did something that I had no idea even existed. It's almost as if the characters are, well, it's very much as if the characters are very real.
You mentioned that you discussed this with a friend of yours who had a Catholic upbringing. Did you, either through the process of writing this book or after you finished this book, talk to any theologians, for instance, to get some sort of input or idea, even just how they would like it?
No, I didn't. Like I said, this is a work of fiction. The theology behind it is not... I don't think it was necessary. I certainly didn't feel the need to discuss the theology with anyone. I was creating a fictional world. It was based on the mythology that we are comfortable and familiar with, but that's as far as I took it.
You mentioned that you're contractually obligated to at least two of these books. Was this a difficult pitch when you pitched the story?
It actually was quite a difficult pitch, primarily because the book crosses a number of genres. When I pitched it initially to an agent, I wasn't even sure what genre to call it. I settled on urban fantasy because it took place in an urban setting and it had supernatural elements, and that was about the best fit that I could find as far as categorizing it. It was then pitched to editors as an urban fantasy, but in fact, even in the reviews that I've had, it's interesting to see the different takes that people have on this novel. One review said that readers of horror would like the novel. Others have said that it is a thriller. One has said that paranormal romance readers would enjoy it. So really, it is crossing a number of genres, and that did make it a difficult pitch.
Is it the kind of thing, the book that you've written, Sins of the Angel, is it the kinds of things that you read?
It is. I do read urban fantasy. I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write this particular story is that it is a little bit different from most of the angel stories that are happening out there. The angel stories that are out there right now tend to not be based as much in the mythology that we're familiar with. I think for reasons of people being afraid of the backlash, perhaps they've shied away from delving too deeply into that comfort zone. Apparently, I don't have any such qualms.
Now, I often ask this of authors, especially when they're writing books that are a series. Just on this program earlier, we had a chance to speak with Owen Colfer, who put together the Artemis Fowl books. And I asked him the same question, the question being, when you write something like this, do you ever anticipate that down the road it could be turned into a film or a television movie or even a series? And if so, do you cast it in your mind's eye when you're writing the characters?
My daughters have actually cast it for me. They have very firm ideas of who should play what character in the book. I do bear in mind, I think that for me it plays out like a film in my head to begin with. So, yes, it would translate very, very nicely to the screen. There's a lot of action, a lot of things happening in the film. I tend not to dwell too much on the internal monologue with my characters, so you're getting your information through conversations between characters, seeing things happening. You're seeing what I'm seeing in my head.
The current book, the first book, Sins of the Angels, is available now?
Or... It will be available 2 weeks from today, actually.
And the follow-up will be coming out in March of next year?
Yes, it's exactly 6 months to the day following Sins of the Angels, and that one will be Sins of the Sun.
We look forward to the series. The book is called Sins of the Angels, and Linda, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much for the time, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Linda Poitevin, author of Sins of the Angels. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0109. And you'll find links to Linda's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Terrified that her mother and brother would come to some harm from flying too close to the anniversary of 9/11, 37-year-old Mary Purcell decided the best plan of action would be to call in a bomb threat to the Tucson, Arizona airport. Airport police received an anonymous call from a woman on September 10th saying she overheard her boyfriend and others discussing a plot to bomb Southwest Airlines Flight 2475 that day. Police called bomb squad officials and notified the FBI. Law enforcement took all the luggage off the plane and searched the aircraft and bags while the passengers were double screened. Security throughout the airport was also increased. The FBI investigation ultimately led them to Purcell, who eventually admitted that she made the threat because she didn't want her loved ones flying so close to the anniversary of 9/11. Doesn't help her case that she has a history of deceiving authorities, including 4 felony convictions, 1 for forgery. So she was arrested, and things don't look that good for Mary. They don't look good because, basically, she's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program. Hope you enjoyed it. Number 0109. The website is thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And if you go to the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. And again, just look for the corresponding program number, in this case, 0109. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.